You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Well, time for Family Matters now with you through until around 12 o'clock. Of course, the midday report coming with you after that. 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Those are the numbers to dial. Plenty coming up in the next little while. We're talking Family Matters, and of course, we're talking to our clinical psychologist, Jose Giane, and she's on the line to us now. Jose, good day to you. Good morning. Nice to talk.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Nice to talk to you too.
So we're talking about children and diversity. And I mean, there's been a lot of talk about, I don't want to say there's been a lot of talk about diversity, that would be putting it on sort of too small a term, but we have all sorts of discussions in our society about, I suppose, managing, maybe is the wrong word, maybe proper integration, maybe even that's not the right word. Assimilation is a word that comes up all the time.
Absolutely.
Where would you start?
Even I think the starting point is, you know, if I may just make the obvious even more obvious, just to foreground our discussion is that a striking feature of this integration, if we can use that word for now, is that it takes place against the backdrop of our apartheid history, which dictated, then decreed, you know, using legal instruments such as the Group Areas Act, the Immorality Act, Separate Amenities Act, that simply on the basis of our racial-cultural differences, who had access to what areas of residence, what amenities, and what relational associations we may form. And so that means that as we begin right now to talk about diversity and integrating that diversity, it takes place against that backdrop, and it means that our starting blocks have been positioned in such a way that we actually are talking more about assimilation than we are about integration.
So what you're saying is that one, I'll have to use the word culture, I think, Jose, I can't see another word, is still dominant. So, I mean, let's call it what it is. You will have formerly white schools, Model C schools is the kind of code we use. And you will have black children, black learners coming from township areas often, and they're going to these schools, and then they have to play rugby and they have to know how to do that. That's the kind of, in a shorthand way.
That's just one side of the equation, Stephen. The other side is that we don't see a reciprocal movement in the opposite direction. Mm. And so, you know, I always kind of have a picture of the kids that are leaving townships in the morning. I wish one day I could climb on Aki's helicopter and just capture in some way the picture of children that are leaving the township to what is what was historically white areas, and therefore getting into a system that already existed, a system that was created, supported with the necessary infrastructure, and are therefore then indeed entering a system that was not part of their own system initially.
You know, it's so interesting, Jose, because I, you know, I went to a whites-only school for most of my schooling. I mean, this was the country we were at the time.
Yes.
And I'm struck when I take one of my children, he goes to a Model C school. It's not a private school. And it's a northern suburb school, sure. I mean, that's partly where I live and all the rest. And I'm amazed when I love this more than collecting time. It's dropping off time when you really see it because everyone's there at the same time. And I'm amazed at how different the children, but specifically the parents, look compared to how it was when I was at school. Because when I was at school, at the, you know, the whites-only schools that I went to, everybody looked the same. And it was a boys-only school as well. So everyone was the same. There was a specific power structure. But the fathers and the mothers all looked the same. And by that I mean that even now, you know, parents who are white that I will see, they will have jewelry in their faces that no parent would ever have had at the schools that I went to.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of... It is one of the most cheerful things that I do. Does that make any sense? And
no,
yet,
absolutely. I mean, indeed, the times they are changing. And however, you know, things may look different and appreciably so, you know, positively so on the surface.
It's the structure that hasn't changed.
Absolutely. There are sediments within and below that surface appearance that we need to be conscious of also. That it is not simply that you just kind of have put all the starting blocks on the same line now and everybody just starts on that block and just continues as if it's business or schooling or life as usual.
So where do you start? You've got a child at a school that is integrated. And I mean, it's fascinating as well that when I say integrated, I almost by definition mean in Joburg, a northern suburb school, a Model C school, because I think you could argue that township schools are still 98 or more percent just black learners. But if you have a child at a school that has this diversity, where do you start when, you know, the child is going to school? What issues are you expecting to crop up?
Sure. You know, and I'm going to just put my cards on the block here in terms of saying I'm thinking primarily from a black person's perspective right now.
Of course, yeah.
Because I think that's where the majority of these considerations come into play. Mm. And of course, they then enter a system that is of, you know, a white racial and racial cultural background. But I'm going to start at this point in terms of saying, so, you know, there's that adage that says, he or she who controls your language controls your thinking.
Yeah.
And so the first currency that stands out in that process, in this discussion, for me, the most, you know, striking the issue becomes the language and languaging of things.
Mm.
Because it then begins to change. It begins to speak to who we are as a people. And I have to say that I personally wrestle with it. And on some level, thankfully, I wrestle from the outside in the sense that I'm child-free, so I don't actually get to get my feet in the mud as such. But as an observer on the sidelines, I notice the struggle and the rub that as the black community, we go through in this process.
Mm.
Where you find a symptom of it being black children who can't speak their own languages.
Mm. Mm. And it's something people comment on often, and you see it all the time. And I'm always interested in that because it is something that is taken hold in a really strong way. Where you see young black children being spoken to in English by their parents at the one time when you'd expect that would be their mother tongue time, if I can put it like that.
Absolutely. That's the ultimate paradox in this, isn't it? That as we're seeking to say, yes, let us recognize, let us honor, let us celebrate, let us embrace and work with our diversity, it doesn't seem like we are bringing it to the table, are we?
Why do you think it is, Khosi? I mean, the parents are making a decision. I mean, and I know being a parent that you don't get to think through everything. A lot of it is unfortunately making it up as you go along, because that's what children are. They throw things at you. You have to answer immediately. And if you don't believe me, just, you know, think of how you answer the question in the middle of a formal dinner, Dad, where do baby hippos come from?
I'll have to take your word on this one, Stephen, thankfully.
So
I think, you know, it is one that as we, and again, I'm going to kind of stretch our context a little in terms of saying that we as a country are also not just in our small communities, but in the macro scale have entered a bigger global stage, you know, and therefore we kind of, as parents, are also thinking about how do we prepare our children for that stage, you know, of life that we need to play into as a country, and the opportunities and challenges, of course, that brings in. But bringing that to the micro level of the family, you know, the challenge becomes, here are these kids that are as innocent as they are and open and receptive and so on. And they, from a black person's perspective, are being moved from. And let's speak for a majority of township kids, because in terms of residentials, the black people that live in the suburbs, it's a kind of different conversation, although the nuances are pretty much the same.
Yeah.
But if you look at it right from the basics of a child who lives Soweto, you know, who speaks all the languages that are spoken in Soweto, who then in the morning at 4:45 has to be bussed out into a suburb of a school where the predominant language and the guiding, the only language, so to speak, is English or Afghans in some cases. And so the challenge becomes, how do they get into that system and function?
You know what I find fascinating about it? Because there is an argument, and I know it's a strong argument from the linguists and the educationalists, the people who study those, to say that young children should learn and all children should learn in their mother tongues. And I remember discussing this once on the Midday Report, and it made sense, and I was completely convinced. And someone tweeted me and simply said, I cannot think of a quicker way of resegregating our schools than introducing classes in Zulu, Xhosa, and Sotho. And I was amazed at that because I thought, actually, I can't get around that argument either, if that makes sense. And this goes to the reason that English is dominant is not just because of the colonial aspects of it, although that's part of it. It's also because literally of, you know, MTV and the language of all of the channels, almost all of them on DSTV. It's because of the language of this radio station, and this language is such because it's the one language that everyone, for various reasons, will understand. I mean, there's a reason why the ANC conducts its business in English as well.
Yes.
And I kind of feel we can't get around that. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Apart from the fact that there's at least 15 other languages in that sort of same room, so to speak. And then what becomes the one unifying language, it becomes kind of more the practicalities of doing it in English as well. But of course, there are the deeper historical nuances to it. Yeah, and I think, you know, it is that dilemma. Which way do we turn? And one of the challenges becomes that in trying to cultivate a sense of self in the black child, and by the same token, you then nullify a critical aspect of who they are as black people, which is their language. When the very parents, as the primary socializing agents, are not even speaking to them in their own language anymore. So what makes them understand who they are as a black people?
Sure. That's just the starting point for the conversation. We're talking to Horsey Gianni. She's a clinical psychologist. It's Family Matters on 702 and Cape Talk with you through until 12 o'clock the time. Don't forget the Midday Report with Clement Maniatella coming up after that. Mork, we're taking your calls for Horsey on 011-883-0702 and 021-446-0567.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Stephen Critterson for Eusebius McKaiser, you with Family Matters, Horsey Gianni, our clinical psychologist on the line. Horsey, I've been trying to sort of, you know, and obviously as a parent there, you sort of try and work out what the best thing to do is. And I've been thinking about being one of the parents who, you know, it's amazingly, you know, easy for me because of the sort of history of the country that my child goes to a school where the education is not hugely different. He's taught certainly in the same language and sometimes horribly from the same books that I was. But let me get to where I'm trying to go. So I would think, okay, if I was a parent and I was living, say, in Meadowlands, right, and I was sending my child to a Model C school in a suburb north of Meadowlands, and I would think, well, I want my child to do well. So to do that means they need these various tools. They need to speak English to do that. They need to have a rugby ball to do that. All of those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that is how we got here, because parents are making decisions that they think are in their child's best interests. And if you were to argue with them and say, that's not in your child's best interests, they will say, perhaps, I mean, I can't put words in anyone else's mouth and everyone has their own experience, but I would think it would be rational for them to say, but I'm doing what's best for my child in the system as it is now. This is best for them because this is going to get them the education that I think they need and the education that the people at the top of the system have, and so they'll get to the top of the system with it.
Yeah, and I guess, Stephen, we're talking here about a multiplicity of competing priorities, and as you rightfully say, I mean, as parents, you don't have the luxury of that I have, perhaps, of sitting and kind of you know, psychologizing about it to the same extent. But I think my question becomes, is it either or? Is the yardstick that we're using to define what success means a healthy one?
Yes.
One that says success can only be spoken to in the sanitization of blackness. Is that the price that success must come at for us to define it and therefore say this is the path that we then want to mark for our children to follow?
Yeah, it comes back to everything though, which is that, you know, you need time and resources to do it all, don't you? All right, let's go to the lines. Oh, Ubakwe is on the line from Tswane. Oh, Ubakwe, hi, good day to you.
Hello, how are you?
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. This issue of children, man, I happen to have, my wife is from Limpopo, she's Mulubedu.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Mutswana.
Yeah.
And I'm a serious believer in this thing of my children must speak my language.
Yeah.
But they found it very difficult. I have a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old who can't speak any of our languages. Simply because we, the parents, speak English here and there. Because of obviously our background, that we don't speak the same language.
Yeah. Which is pretty much the widow, yeah.
Yes, we speak our languages with a mix of English. But then they go to school but speak solely English, which is a problem. And I think the problem with this is that united in our diversity is not necessarily a solution.
Mm.
We probably needed to have adopted one African language and developed it in such a way that you can go to Pretoria and have children learning in an African language as opposed to having to have 11 classes, separate classes, which is very not practical, actually.
I think the problem
comes from there, that we are such a big country and we cannot have languages that every single person go to this school and is expected to be catered for.
Yeah.
Because everywhere in Africa it happens that you get to Uganda, you find people speaking in Uganda. You get to Malawi, people speaking Chichewa. You get to Tanzania, people speaking Swahili. And here we expect to say we are united in our diversity, and I think that alone actually separates us.
Yeah,
interesting. We need to have some language that unites us as Africans in South Africa.
Yeah. Oh, Bakwe, I mean, you make an interesting point. And Jose, if I can just build on that point a little, is I saw a stat somewhere, and I'd need to check it down. I don't have it in front of me, so I'd need to just check it. But something like 85% of the high schools in Gauteng teach in English, right? And then you think, okay, so what language are the other 15%? And they'll be teaching in Afrikaans.
Yeah.
And then you'll have claims, and I don't want to say whether I agree with these claims or not, but the claims come that the Afrikaans community is somehow more isolated from the rest of South Africa and is not integrated as much. And I mean, it'll be different in different parts of the Afrikaans community. But do you see the point that I'm making is that if you do divide along Afrikaans, you don't have diversity in the end, which is what we're trying to talk about.
Indeed. Whichever way you try to cut this cake, it still doesn't, let us off the hook in terms of the dichotomies and the contradictions that are in here within the system itself. But, you know, if the one thing that stands out, and the one thing I've argued, just looking back on our history, and it seems to be the thing that bedevils us today, is that the one thing I always said looking back is that, you know, white people in South Africa missed an opportunity to learn African languages for free because they all had a black woman and a black man working in their yard.
Yeah.
You know, and of course I'm generalizing here, but they had an opportunity to learn, for their kids to learn from the helper.
Yes.
A language.
Yes.
For free. And what then ends up happening is that you need to pay to learn a language that you could have learned for free.
Yeah.
We, on the other hand, I come from Soweto. I know I speak 9 of the 11 languages just by virtue of that.
Mm.
And I'm seeing that what is now currently happening is the exact opposite, where children in the township are not even speaking their own languages anymore.
Mm.
And one of the questions I ask of us is, you know, as adults, we kind of seem to have the burden of needing them to be sanitized into English.
Mm.
And my sense is that children in their naturalness speak languages interchangeably.
Yeah.
They actually don't know that this is Afrikaans and it means this and that. Mm. All constructs that we already have built as adults, and we use those constructs as if they are barriers instead of bridges. Because we learned languages in Soweto. That's how I am able to speak so many languages, 7 being those in the township, of course, English and Afrikaans, which I also learned at school. But it was never really an issue until we kind of put the politics of it into it.
All right. Let's go to Pelelani and Protea Glen. Pelelani, hi.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, man. How are you? Go for it.
Hey, I'm okay. I'm done.
Yes, Dick.
Hey, Stephen, we have the same problem here in Protea, where we have a school, a primary school, where you have children coming from Sotho, Tswana, Zulu, West now, those coming from Zimbabwe. They are part of the school. So we were called in by the principal as the SGP to say, which language are we going to use, which is an African language that will dominate? The problem was we could not choose either, because here in Protea, it's a developing area, and we come from different backgrounds, different home languages. So we had to resolve that English will be the medium language of communication, because that's the only thing, that's the only language we can utilize. So we are sitting with that problem, even though we really want to teach our children to know isiNdebele, like me and Kosi, we are Ndebeles, but unfortunately, we cannot under the circumstances unless something drastically happens.
Yeah, I mean, Pelelani, I think you've actually put it in a nutshell in a way. I think that's really what's happened. Jose,
sure. And Stephen, I hear that and I fully appreciate that. That's my cousin, by the way. Hello to the rest of the family and friends. But back to business. The issue for me is, I can understand in that context. I think for me, the tragedy, where it pains me, is when these kids come home and they cannot find their Africanness anywhere. It's one thing in the school for those reasons, for practicalities and so on. It's when they cannot find themselves, their Africanness anywhere else.
Yeah. Okay, Jose, I do want to introduce another aspect, and you're lucky your cousin listens, only my mother listens. I did want to introduce this, and I don't want to move away from language, because as you say, it's the foundation of it. But one of the things that also I think must surely matter is the number of black teachers at Model C schools, and in the schools that I've come into contact with, and it's by no means all of them, but I've often sort of been struck by the number is not nearly as large as I thought it would be, and that must mean particularly, if I'm a white father, which I am, and my children are white as well, and I know that, for example, my children will come across people in subservient, or should I say, people with less power in society, so waiters, domestic workers, etc., the person with the petrol attendant, they will all be black, almost all. And so you want them to have black authority figures. I think that's important. And yet there seems to be a shortage of that. And it doesn't help when the black authority figures in society are people on election posters, let me put it like that. And so, you know, there's a shortage as well, I would argue, still, of black authority figures with legitimacy for black children, but also for white children.
And, you know, again, it goes back to the basic of saying, so as much as, you know, historically we've seen white teachers coming into black schools, we've not seen equally the same happening in the opposite direction. We didn't see it in apartheid times, and I think, and I speak corrected here, I've worked for 5 years for an NGO in rural northern KwaZulu-Natal in Sisulu, working to school, you know, with schools in the middle of nowhere to the border of Swaziland and Mozambique. There was no white teacher to speak about there. But certainly in the more urban schools, I think there's beginning to be a presence of black teachers, but of course the numbers, you know, we can discuss the enoughness of the numbers. But for example, my sister is a teacher, and she was sharing with me recently, and this is something that struck me, and it's a question I would like for us to think about, that she went to a school, and I remember in my high school years driving past the school on the double decker bus on my way to Rosebank, and it was lily white, and she now has been to that school. And apparently, you know, it is virtually an all black school. Another friend shared a similar thing in a different school, which was, you know, in a similar way, transformed into a black school virtually. And my question is, where have the white kids gone and why?
White people, they can buy their way out of integration if they need to. I think that'll be one of the critiques that we might hear. Jose Gianni is a clinical psychologist. You're with Family Matters. The lines are abuzz. We're going to the lines next.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
14 minutes to 12 o'clock. Midday report with Clement Taylor. After that, Stephen in for Eusebius. Jose Gianni is our clinical psychologist. We're talking about diversity, talking about children and diversity and language. Megan in Kaya Sands. Megan, hi.
Good day, Stephen. How are you?
I'm well. Go for it.
Good. I respect the conversation that's going on right now, and it's awesome to have, but I do have a spanner in the works, please. English is a, well, universal language, and if you want to get a job in the workplace, you know, you need to be able to speak English, especially if you want to travel abroad. So how do you get across that? Because, you know, if you go overseas, people don't understand Xhosa and Zulu and stuff like that. So how would you, you know, you've got to learn English, and so that's what you have to start with in a Model C school, or am I not understanding the topic correctly?
Okay, yeah, Megan, all right, no, I understand. I suppose the question would be, are there children in China who are learning in English? I don't know about that. Let's go to Zakes and Naledi in Soweto. Zakes, hi.
Hi, Steve, how are you?
All right, how are you? Go for it.
Good. Look here, I have four daughters who have went to private schools.
Yeah.
Where English was supposed to be their first home language.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a risk I took.
Yeah.
However, when I had said to them, I had inculcated it, all of them, that English is a commercial language.
Yeah.
Your mother tongue, which is Setswana, their mother is Motswana and Umzulu.
Mm-hmm.
Then I said, you'll have to have a balance of those three languages, because the language, your African language, is your vehicle to your culture, whereas the English is your commercial language, which has got nothing to do with your culture.
Yeah.
So now, all I'm saying is, the cult that is now, our children need, as Africans, we need to inculcate in our children the appreciation of the African languages. They speak both of those languages fluently, as well as English. So now, the first school is at home. The first pedagogic center is at home, not at school. So that now we cannot blame the government or whatever institution is in place when our children have lost the appreciation of the African languages. I insist on that. Their mother teaches them Setswana whilst I teach them Sizulu, so that they appreciate not only the cultural differences, but how those two cultures assimilate eventually, especially when we do tombstones.
Yeah, no, of course. All right, Zakes, congratulations, you've been able to do it. Ida on the line from Joburg South, you haven't been able to do it. Hi, Ido. Ido?
Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Yeah.
You're on the radio, mate. Go for it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I'm on. It was just the last caller was saying he wants his kid to learn Sindebele and whatever, but the kid can learn Sindebele at home. I mean, the issue is whether when we debate this issue of the language, whether we want to use language as a communication tool or also language as a way of acquiring education.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think the issue was also that when we said use mother tongue, the people who are espousing that are saying up to a certain standard. You understand that when kids they are still at primary school at whatever grade, they must learn in their mother tongue, right? And then after that, I mean, we're not expecting people to learn in their mother tongue, maybe at university, you know. I mean, there could be that choice when there are resources, but we understand that, you know, people are going to learn in English because they're going to operate at a commercial level. So the issue here is to afford kids the opportunity to learn in mother tongue at certain grades, because it has been proved scientifically that they learn better, you know, they perform better, you know. So that's why what should be happening.
I agree with you, Ido, but as I said earlier, I mean, then you're stuck with a problem that you would have young children in separate classrooms, and that's what worries me. I mean, as a South African, you don't want that either. I don't know what the answer is to it.
Steve, you know, in Soweto, in the township, you know that when it was it will be the same thing. When it's a science class, it's a science subject, kids who are doing science are going to English class. Those who go to the, What is the separation about? Physical aid means when it's English, the kids who are not doing English, it's the same thing that as when you are a class, when those who are doing math, they go out and go into a math class. And then they come back
I mean, remember that story about that private school that had like an English class and an Afrikaans class? And you see it at some of the universities as well. And then the Afrikaans class is all white and the English class is black. I mean, this is where it gets complicated. But Ido, I take your point. And Ntaba Seng, hi, where did you send your daughter?
Hello?
Hello, Ntaba Seng. Yes, I am. Where did you send...
My story is a bit complicated, but yeah, I took my daughter to an Afrikaans school in Zulake.
Mm-hmm.
I just won't mention the name, but it's a private school. And it was a sign of rebellion, Stephen. She was going to grade one, and she had been at Crawford for 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, like the pre-zero, double-zero, whatever. And now she was going to grade one to start new proper schooling. And out of rebellion, I spoke to my husband and I said, I'm taking her to an all-African school. And she was to be the first black student who would be paying school fees. And why are they in school? They did teach, they did afford kids of the other helpers, you know, the helpers in the school, the black mummies that are helping the little kids in the primary. They allowed some of their kids. So I think there were about four other black kids in the school.
But in terms of saying,
not in her grade.
Can I just ask why you said it was an act of rebellion?
Yes, absolutely, Stephen. I went to Soweto. I schooled in Soweto. Sorry, my other phone is ringing, but I'm not going to answer it. So, I schooled in Soweto.
Yeah. All right, Ntaba Seng, I'm sorry. I mean, I do want to hear your story. Are you still with us, Ntaba Seng?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I still want to get to why rebellion. You said you went to school in Soweto, so why?
Yes. I went to school in Soweto, and I was affected by the 1976, the whole thing. And I went to university at UJ. The reason I only got accepted at UJ is because I was going to study advertising. And it was only UJ that was offering it in Johannesburg, because I couldn't go far. And it was the my inability to connect, being taught in Afrikaans at UJ. It was RAU. It was RAU then. It was not called UJ. And we were taught in Afrikaans. We had to attend classes in the day in Afrikaans. And then we'd go home and start reading the chapters to try and follow in English. And that made me so bitter and so angry with Afrikaans. So I took my child to an Afrikaans school. She's in grade 7 now. She is fluently Afrikaans. When I got there, they asked me if she could anywhere else, and I said, no, she doesn't. And they said, this school is too expensive. You want to put your child for me? And I said, try her. I'm going to support my child. I want her to go here, and I'm going to pay the school fees. And they took her. The school was amazing. She did exceptionally well. I teach her African languages at home, of course.
Yeah. We're beginning to lose the line, but Ntaba Seng, I think we have heard the story. I'm sorry about that, on the line from Midrand. Dominique on Randburg, I think probably the last call on this. Dominique, hi, go for it.
Hello, Stephen.
Oh, hello, go for it.
Well, I think the first thing is that children do not lack the capacity to learn. They only lack teachers.
Yeah.
And therefore, we need to be very deliberate. So, learning a language, you can't just do it colloquially. This is Zulu, Setswana, and all other South African, you know, the ones that we deem to be official, are just as complex as English, with the adverbs and the pronouns and you cannot learn that in the street.
Yeah.
And therefore, as parents, we need to ensure that even if it is an extra class, much like kids in private school take French, take Spanish as an extra class, why on earth are we not doing Zulu, Setswana, Sesotho as extra classes for the children?
Other
thing is around the transformation. Until we do have transformation where we have black-owned firms, then the languages or indigenous African languages won't be welcome in the commercial space. South Africa is the only exception in Africa where English is the franca lingua. If you go to Ghana, if you go to Nigeria, if you go to Kenya, you'll find Blackboard members that engage in their own languages.
Yeah. All right, Dominic,
so South Africa is a bit of an anomaly, but we sort of like resigned ourselves to just accepting the status quo as it is.
I'm sorry, Dominic, I didn't mean to cut you off there. We do have literally 30 seconds, though. Jose, Akhtar, psychologist with us on Family Matters, Jose Gianni. I mean, it's such an interesting question. There's so many strong views on this.
Absolutely. And Stephen, you know, for me, the cliffhanger that I want to go back to is you spoke. on before we went to break about the fact that white people can buy their way out of the integration. I'm keen to hear what are the push and pull factors for those people that make this, you know, for them to leave the schools. And what does it mean about the importance of integration for those parents in relation to their children and their, how they see their children in future?
And we haven't even got to some of the other questions that, that we could really get to when we talk about a diverse society. There's so much to it. But Khosi Gianni, thank you very much indeed. I've really enjoyed it. It's nice to talk to you long form for a change.
Thank you, Stephen. Yes, we're not bumping into each other at least.
Khosi Gianni, thank you. Clinical psychologist with Family Matters. Just a couple of tweets because there have been so many on this. People talking about this. Funny underscore democracy says, I still don't understand what the act of rebellion in Thaba Seng was talking about. Khaukhelo Maroka says, why don't white kids learn African languages as a standard feature? Why are they denied? I think they do now. I'd like to think so. Mumsy Tolo says, my kids went to previously white schools. They speak African languages and English. I insist, Zulola, is the way she's put it. Tabo says, China was never colonized by Britain. Not the same example you gave. However, Hong Kong was, and they do teach in English as well. The point I was making was that the person was saying that English was a universal language. In other words, the language of international business. And so my point then was, do people in China learn in English? That was the question I was asking. I don't know the answer to it.